This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you don't leave home without your car, you're not going to be trying to return home without your car. The point being that we need something that breaks that behavior at the point where people set out. And somehow that has to be the completeness of a system that they trust to get them home again without taking their own means of locomotion.
Nobody hitchhikes anymore. Back in the 1980s, getting a ride with a stranger became decidedly untrendy. Rugged individualism was in, and ride-sharing was out. But now, with the advent of social media and mobile platforms, ride-sharing is making a comeback. This week's guests on Sea Change Radio are Paul Minot, the founder of the Ride-Sharing Institute in Auckland, New Zealand, and Mark Svenvold, a journalist and professor at Seton Hall University, who recently profiled Minot's work on ride-sharing for Orion magazine. Dubbed by some as the Johnny Appleseed of the new ride-sharing, Minot points out that if everybody carpooled one day a week, we could see as much as a 20% reduction in traffic volumes. The corresponding reduction in traffic jams and carbon emissions would also be pretty great. Catch a ride with us now across the planet to hear what it will take to put ride-sharing back in vogue. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by two special guests, one from New Zealand, Paul Minot. He is the co-founder of the Ride Sharing Institute, and Mark Svenvold, who's a professor of poetry and nonfiction writing at Seton Hall University and a journalist coming to us from New Jersey. Good to have you both on the show at the same time. Paul and Mark, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks.
Thanks, Alex.
Mark, if you can explain why the work that Paul has done, you refer to him as the Johnny Appleseed of ride sharing in your Orion magazine piece, why it's such important work.
In 2009, I heard Paul speak at the Carbon Economy Conference in Washington, D.C., and it was such a simple idea to reduce the number of people and to reduce traffic that I was very compelled by, as were was everybody else at the conference. And a year ago or so, I wanted to check in and see how this idea was going. So that's why I wrote the article for Orion Magazine. And the simple fact of the matter is that traffic congestion is a big problem. It's one of the problems that so many people are familiar with. We spend 19 days annually inside our cars, almost a solid week in traffic annually on average. And as Paul indicated, it's because, most of us, 76% of us, drive to work alone. And as Paul was saying in 2009, here are certain ways that we can, if we shared the ride, if we filled up some of those seats, it's a cheap, inefficient, efficient, effective way of helping relieve that problem. The problem's not going away because as half the world's population moves into the middle class, so the one of the things that people want to buy is a car. There'll be 1.6 billion cars on Earth by 2025, 1 billion more people on the planet. A staggering $4 trillion will be needed annually by 2025 just to meet the demand for infrastructure, a lot of it related to transportation. So if we can't, and we have all these cities and people already living on there, so we're not going to necessarily be able to build our way out of the problem, but we can think our way out. And there's some interesting new developments that were happening that are part of an intersection between mobile application and social media.
Maybe you could tell us some of the latest developments that some of these ride-sharing grassroots taxi services like Lyft and Uber are doing in the carpooling space.
Yeah. Paul uses I saw this YouTube of him discussing and observing casual carpooling in San Francisco, and it is a really interesting phenomena. It just, and he called it a silent system based on trust, a silent commuter system based on trust. And this kind of informal transit or paratransit system exists actually all over the world. And you know, in fact, the founder of Zimride is hit that the name of John Zimmer. Does not come from his own name, but comes from the sort of informal transit system of Trotros in Zimbabwe. So it's been the emerging economies who have been trying to find their own, that often don't have good mass transit systems, that a lot of these new ideas are coming from. And what the informal taxi service companies are doing, they're just using social media to, you have an application like Lyft. Here's what happens. You come out of your hotel room in San Francisco, say, you want a ride. Instead of hailing a taxi, you open up your Lyft application, you press, I need a ride, and you know, there's a response that says, you know, Jose will be there in 2 minutes. And a car pulls up to your side. There is a late model car. It's clean as a whistle. You already know the driver's name, and you hop in. At the end of your ride, you press a button on your application. The idea is that the payment system is seamless, and there's a built-in sort of infrastructure of trust that's developed. And it's really taken hold in San Francisco and Austin and other cities. And it's very different. It usually is within a large city. It's about getting across town, getting from A to B within a city, right? So that's what that's what the Uber, sidecar, Lyft whole thing is about. And what my story and article is about is about using that whole methodology to apply it towards your commute, your daily commute, to get across, you know, many, you know, like an hour commute away or half hour commute away or whatever happens to be. To be able to walk out of the vision is to be able to walk out of your home, hit a button, and so-and-so who's also going your way will just pull up in your car, and then you share. And the challenge, of course, is like getting enough data, a large enough database where there'll be enough matches in real time to enable you to do that. Building out an infrastructure of trust so that you get rid of what they call stranger danger. Finding a way to incentivize riders to pick up passengers and people to be willing to become passengers. If I can just tell a little anecdote that I learned from a researcher at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Urban Development. She told me a story about this gentleman named David Kanyara, who lived in Nairobi, and they have a system of matutus. It's an informal transit system, all confused, all working, but he rode around on his bicycle with a handheld GPS device and put a dot on all the little stops of the matutu routes, and for the first time made a single map of the matutu system, and what Columbia University is doing is making digital matutu, trying to make all of this visible. And that's a note that I thought that Paul Manette struck in his when I was been talking to him. The key to solving congestion problems is making the traffic visible for everybody. And as soon as we can start understanding in real time and putting a value on people who are willing to become passengers, as he has said so eloquently, that's when, and then people will know, maybe it's time for me to switch, and there's an incentive for me to switch, and then to becoming a passenger, and that will help reduce traffic. But it's that visibility quality that I think he's argued so well for, whereas others are saying, well, let's price the freeway. Let's, you know, if it's a certain time of day, it's that whole congestion pricing idea, which is it's an incentivizing way of thinking about things. But I like the idea a little better of giving neighborhoods, communities, people a choice.
The asked if I believe, and do the angels really grieve, or is it all a comforting invention? It's like gravity, I said, it's not a product of my head. It doesn't speak, but nonetheless commands attention. I don't care what it means, who decorates the scenes. The problem is more with a sense of pride that keeps me thinking me instead of what it is to be. I'm not a passenger, I am the ride. I'm not a passenger, I am the ride.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Paul Minot. He's the founder of the Ride Sharing Institute in Auckland, New Zealand, and also Mark Svenvold, a journalist and professor at Seton Hall University. So, Paul, if you can give us some insight into how ride sharing has transformed since you started working on it.
Thanks, Alex. How it's transformed since I started working on it is, I'd almost look at it and say there's been this shift or this drive towards technological solutions, and there's sort of a feeling that it's not going to be much fun if there isn't a tech solution, and that if somehow the iPhone can solve this problem, that would be kind of correct in the order of the way things are supposed to work. From a sort of a transcendental sort of a perspective. What I've seen, the Lyft and Uber taxi services are taxi services. They're really no different in their initial form that they've held for the first couple of years of operation. They are just taxis that use an app that is a bit smarter than what taxi companies have used. But the difference is that they can call on a much larger resource, because anybody who's got a phone and a car can respond. And Mark's numbers about how, I won't argue with the numbers about how many cars are because I can't count them. There's a lot of cars out there. And so there's a lot of capacity that's sitting waiting to respond. However, the reality is with those services that they actually add trips. They actually add vehicle miles. If you were going to drive yourself and instead you called an Uber trip, that Uber car is going to come and get you. It's going to take you where you're going. It's going to drop you off. Then it's going to go back. Sometimes it might hang around, but that person really doesn't have a reason to be where you are. Whereas ride sharing, in a sense of what we want to do to change the traffic, is actually about saying, how do we take you in your trip while you're going to work and have somebody else ride with you? Not necessarily to your work, but to somewhere nearby. And the interesting question, I think, is what it takes for that to change in a sufficiently significant way that we have less traffic congestion. And, you know, a lot of these things are being developed in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was there in June and at an event that was put on by Agrion. One of the speakers was an innovation person from the Metropolitan Transport Commission. San Francisco is fantastic. You know, you've got BART and then you've got all of these other options. And with the reviving of the economy, which never really went that down that much in San Francisco, apparently, with the reviving of the economy, they are now having problems with getting people onto BART at 4:30 in the afternoon. So you've got traffic congestion out on the road, but you've also got people congestion on BART. You know, people are having to wait two or three trains before they can get on their ride home at 4:30 p.m. And so what I've seen develop is I've seen lots of ideas tested. I've honestly yet to see one that really is making a difference to the traffic. There are some small and interesting ideas, such as one that that Mark talks about in the article, where perhaps you're just trying to find a like-minded person to travel in the traffic with. So it's about leveraging that time that's still going to be traffic. So the question is whether you're trying to set up an app to provide a service in the middle of everything that's going wrong, or as what I set out to do and still am pursuing, is trying to find something that solves the problem. And one of my conclusions is it's actually not a transportation engineering problem.
What is the problem then?
The problem is happening in the top 2 inches of the, as somebody eloquently puts, and I'm not sure who said this first, but the top 2 inches of the heads of the people. We use the system in a very dumb way. You know, so what happened was through the 50s, they built the interstate, and basically as the car expanded, the availability of the car expanded, the number of cars expanded, we were able to plow a new road through. We were able to expand the road. And at some point, public transport, and certainly, I mean, if you go back, public transport came first. In order to develop a suburb, in order to get people to and from your piece of land, if you were a developer, you provided some sort of a railway and then a road. And so what happened was the response to too many cars was, okay, we'll just expand the road. Well, as we all know, that method doesn't work anymore. And you can spend $3 trillion, it's an amazing number that Mark refers to. You can spend that and you can keep on trying to expand the roads and putting on public transport. But the sheer problem with the roads is that, you know, 3/4 of the space, in fact, far more than 3/4 of space is empty.
Is the best way to go about this having incentives through public policy, and what kind of policies do you think would catalyze this change? Or do you think this has to be coming from a grassroots movement and just from a basic need?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And as Paul has noted, you have to put a value on passengership. That's the phrase that I think is useful. Putting a value on passengership is necessary, and that's going to probably come from the private sector, and it's also going to come from the public sector as well. It's going to be a combination of these things. We have a situation, we've emerged, there are several presuppositions that are working in our sense of traffic. The dominant one is that the roads should be free, you know, should be able to free to ride the roads as however I want. But the problem with that is if it is free, then you end up with what we have now. And so there, as Paul was saying, we've got to find ways to incentivize people to switch to being passengers. Now, the recommendations from places like Texas A&M, the Transportation Institute, are, you know, adding some capacity, right? But also just using what we have and providing choices. That's one of the findings that this recent report says, giving people choices that might incentivize people, and also diversifying developmental patterns. I mean, if you just continually build outward away from the city, that is not going to help things at all. And there's this other sort of ontological problem, if you will, that's sort of dancing around that people are trying to understand is the notion of the car as an extension of the self. You know, the extension in an era where we have everybody's pressed for time, the automobile is one of these interior spaces where we are alone for once, you know, during the day. It's sometimes viewed as a sort of an extension of the living room. Is there a way in which we can address that problem? And part of it has to do with this whole idea of passengership, with the whole idea of making the transit system visible, so that we know, and making communities aware that they actually, as a community, have a choice. There's this been hub and spoke idea, where the center, the destination has been, you know, the employer. Everyone has been focused on the, you know, where people work as point B. That's, we have to all focus on that. Build a database base around, you know, the destination of the employer. And other companies like Karma in Austin and in San Francisco are saying, well, maybe it actually should start with the community. You know, maybe we need to build the database around communities first, and instead of working on a hub and spoke with the employer at the center, think of a fork model where you have communities along the tines of the fork that are nearby each other, actively engaged, and then all converging on the main arterial, if you will.
Damn this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn, this traffic jam. Time I get home, my supper will be cold. Damn, this traffic jam. Well, I left my job about 5 o'clock. It took 15 minutes to go 3 blocks. Just in time to stand in line with the freeway looking like a parking lot. Damn, this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn, this traffic jam. Time I get home, my supper will be cold. Damn, this traffic jam.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Paul Minot, the founder of the Ride Sharing Institute in Auckland, New Zealand, as well as Mark Svenvold, who's a journalist and professor at Seton Hall University. So what areas that are being explored right now beyond the glorified taxi cab sharing that we've been discussing, what are some of the efforts right now that have either of you most excited?
Well, I think that most of the technology for addressing traffic congestion already exists, and it really is about deploying it and also about working with the regulatory bodies. And what I mean by that, for instance, is let's say for one example, a technological thing that already exists is the radio RFIDs, radio frequency identification. If more and more these things are being installed in cars, so that cars will the location of a car or locations of lots of cars are going to be findable, and that's corresponding to this whole realm of big data and big data analytics, where if you get a whole big set of these cars that are pinging away their frequency, you'll be able to analyze the traffic flows and predict congestion a little better. So there's a lot of work on that already being done. And the World Economic Forum has done some work on that. And traffic congestion centers in major cities are starting to think about these things. They're starting to be built and starting to work, and like Paul said, the autonomous car would probably play a part in all of that, but it in many ways the that's going to come head on with regulatory policies and issues of privacy and data security. So there's a lot of things that have to kind of fall into place for full deployment of these ride-sharing issues and ride-sharing technologies.
And Paul, what are you most excited about?
I've got to say I'm a pessimist in a sense that there's not a lot that's happening, in my view, that is moving towards finding a solution. But I do get excited when I hear about people trying new things to and actually getting out there and testing new ideas to find things that will work. There is a concept called shared use mobility that goes beyond just ride sharing. It includes bike sharing and car sharing. And I think that there's a need for an urban area to have a range of supporting solutions so that when you travel as a passenger, you aren't likely to get stranded. One of the problems of not taking your car is the feeling that I won't be able to get back. And so there needs to be, you know, a good guaranteed ride home service. There needs to be a cheap taxi service that's really available during the day when you're at work without your car. There needs to be bike share so you can get around, and it needs to be inexpensive. There needs to be car share so that you can get around, and it needs to be inexpensive. And all of these things, and the exciting thing is these are getting developed. You've got Car2Go, for example. You've got bike sharing coming in a lot of cities, and you've got guaranteed ride home. And then you also need circulator buses in the center. You need the buses sort of getting people around, so you, when you arrive in one area of the city, you easily can get to another area of the city. These are all pieces that I think fit into a total picture that enables mobility, but they won't work if we just expect them to suddenly reach a tipping point that everybody's going to do something different without a lot of different thought about how we are putting this all together at the moment and what the incentives are, with only the price of parking being seen in people's minds as the marginal cost of jumping in my car and going. We haven't got enough there to attract them away from that. I don't think we're going to create the situation where people are attracted away. And I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but that's, at the moment, the direction that most people are going is they're waiting for the magical app that is going to solve the problem. And I can't see it coming along. Even the price of petrol doubling, if the price of gas doubles, there will be a lot of people who will hurt. But what they'll look for is a raise in pay so they can get back to the point where they can still go and drive. You know, driving is very difficult to get your head around what it will take to change that basic behavior of crawl out of bed and by default crawl into my car and drive to where I want to go.
I would agree with what Paul said about, I think that it's the regulatory setup, it's the incentivizing setup, and everything else. What Paul was talking about is what people in the transportation business call the multimodal mindset. How's that for a little phrase? All the technology for a multimodal mindset and applicability is there. And the vision is there. People are talking about this, having an app that will let you know where the next subway is, where the express is, where a bicycle stand is, where everything is. And all you have to do without whipping out your wallet to pay for anything is just click another button, and you can just hop from one thing to another thing to another thing and find your way home or find your way to work without much trouble at all. That's available. That's doable. It's just the other stuff of incentivization does seem to be pivotal.
If you don't leave home without your car, you're not going to be trying to return home without your car. Double negative. But the point being that we need something that breaks that behavior at the point where people set out. And somehow that has to be the completeness of a system that they trust to get them home again without taking their own means of locomotion.
And the architecture of trust is slowly emerging. We see it in social media. We see it in the whole new shared economy. People are starting, you know, we see it in couchsurfing.org, which I did when I was writing the piece. I did a lot of shared economy stuff while I was working on this piece. And it's a recognition, generally speaking, that as the founder of Zipcar understood, that this is not really about cars. This is about people and information.
Mark Svenvold and Paul Minot, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Traffic, Chris Smither, and James Taylor. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.